All right, hello everyone, and welcome. Hopefully you can hear me. Sorry, I'm a little bit late, but you know how it is. I couldn't find my microphone. A lot of people said you should buy a new mic with all your Patreon money. I actually did buy a new mic, believe it or not. A really good one. It was one that cost over £100. Unfortunately, I think it's almost too good for streaming. It's like picking up like the internal fan of my computer and things like that. So I've gone back to my older mic. And I think that's better, especially when I'm down here in the garage. Then I made a cup of coffee, and in my rush, I ended up spilling the coffee granules all over the kitchen. And obviously, I had to clean it up before I came down here. So I've been a little bit delayed due to boomerism, essentially, in all ways, not just in technology, but in life in general. So where were we? Okay, so I've hopefully everybody can see my little presentation on the right hand side here. Because I'm down the garage, I will have a cigar with my coffee. And I looked through the collection and thought, well, I don't want to waste a good one, which would be good for a cigar stream. So I'm going to have a Quorum Shade. That's a kind of cheap Nicaraguan cigar. I think that will do for the purposes of this list. So I'm going to light that up now as we get going. A lot of people seem to enjoy the first 60, the kind of back half of the top 100. So I'm glad a little bit different from this channel. And to cap off non-politics week, I thought I would also make my top 100 PC games, and then hopefully I will be able to speak to Dr. Edward Dutton on Sunday to kick off return of my channel proper. Okay, and Edward Dutton very kindly has sent me PDF copies of several of his books, which I'll get a chance to look at before I speak to him. But anyway, where were we? So, first of all, Charlemagne said, oh, actually, I was thinking possibly not 100 games, maybe just 50 games. I mean, I could easily give 200 games. You know, I've been gaming since the mid-80s, mate. So, you know, it's not like there's any shortage of them, but maybe I'll just stop at 50. We'll see, because 100 may be a bit of a squeeze in the time I've got left in non-politics week. People are saying, no, do 100. All right, I'll do 100 then. I tell you what, I might do 100 PC I might do 50 PC games, 50 like every other console and system ever, and we'll see where that takes us. But anyway, where were we here? So, yes. So starting off, you can see I've made a new front cover using my very limited skills. And I think, where were we here? Yes, some errata, some mistakes I made in the first part. So, you know, when you're just talking on your own for 2 hours off the top of your head, and in some cases where you haven't seen these films for some time, you may make a couple of little errors along the way. And if my experience on the internet, if you make a mistake, people are very quick to point it out. And I made several mistakes. One of them was that I mentioned that I love the smell of napalm in the morning. I went during when I was talking about Full Metal Jacket. But of course, that line is said by Robert Duvall in Apocalypse Now. And as I was saying it, I was thinking, hold on a second, that's a different film, isn't it? But, you know, so a lot of people pointed that out. And yeah, fair cop, that was a mistake. I also mentioned that French Connection was in San Francisco. But of course, it's set in New York. I mean, it's a very New York film. so that was a stupid comment from me. I was probably thinking of Bullet, which is another kind of chase film set in San Francisco. Also, Dirty Harry is a San Francisco film. So I don't know. Again, one of those things that you say in the moment. Another thing that was mentioned is that Joe McCarthy had nothing to do with the Hollywood Blacklist. That was actually the House of Un-American Activities Committee, or the HUAC. Yeah, fair enough. And probably the most corrections I got was people saying it's Wolf of Wall Street, not on Wall Street. Okay. Also, Lee, a lot of people are asking me, have I deleted my Twitter account? The answer is no. If you want to find me on Twitter, the handle that you need is at the working man 66, as in order 66. yes, the working man 66 is my new Twitter handle. If you try to find Not Car King, you'll come across an account saying something like Keynesian economics for life. Somebody immediately decided to take the old handle. Yes, every once in a while, I do a Doctor Who style regeneration on Twitter. You know, in the past, this has usually come about because I've been banned. But I, you know, this time I thought, well, it was time. And there are reasons. There are reasons. Now, if anybody ever sees any screenshots of old Twitter accounts of things, I can assure you they were faked and I deny all knowledge. Now, finally, number 70 I missed, and I'll mention that quickly at the top before I get going. Now, a couple of things. A lot of people said, I keep on saying film and not movie. I don't really know what to say about that. Although I did listen to it back. I went on a walk. I took AAA on a walk in a pram, and I listened to a good chunk of what I did. And I said movie on a number of occasions, so I think this is a wild rumor. Also, some people claim that in my Welsh accent I say Phil-el, like that. Is that? I didn't hear that. I just say film. Film. So you've made me very self-conscious about that now. But anyway, I'm going to try to switch it up. You know, movie. What's another phrase? Moving picture. Flick. A lot of people said that my review of every single film was, I like this film because it's dark. So I'm going to try as a challenge to go through the rest of tonight without saying it's dark about any of the films, although basically all of them are. Somebody asked, what was your number 100 pick before In the Company of Men took the spot at the last minute? The answer is the Powell and Pressburger classic, A Matter of Life and Death, which is obviously a better film, like objectively speaking, than most of the films on my list. You know, if you haven't seen A Matter of Life and Death, it's definitely worth watching, because a guy kind of wrongly goes to heaven and he's put on trial to try to justify his life. Very interesting film. I thought In the Company of Men, you know, was more fun. And will I put up the PDF as well as the Excel? Yes, I will. Both the document I'm looking at now and my Master Excel spreadsheet will be made available as shareable Google Drive links, basically as soon as this goes off air. And while it's processing, I'll edit the show notes. Okay. All right. Now, let's see where we were. So, yeah. I mean, this is, for those who missed part one, very quickly, you know, In the Company of Men, Purple Rose of Cairo, Lehane, Drive, Straw Dogs, Sideways, Ten Wellington Place, Heat, Titicat Follies, Suspiria, Punch Drunk Love, A School for Scoundrels, The Cook, The Thief, The Wife and Her Lover, Whiplash, The Warriors, The French Connection, obviously In New York, Zodiac, On the Waterfront, and by the way, if you look at that Twitter account, it is not the name, even though it's at The Working Man, the name is Docker, because I'm claiming to be a working on the docks now in my Twitter profile. 82 Conspiracy, Carry On, At Your Convenience, Harry Brown, Big Trouble in Little China, Dogville, Kill List, Princess Bride, 12 Angry Men, Ip Man, Love, Honor, and Obey, The King of Kong, Magnolia, and number 70 was The Raid. And I'll just stop here very quickly to talk about The Raid. Basically, all the stuff I said about John Wick is true of The Raid. Perfect action film. The storyline is done and dusted in the first 2 minutes. And what I love about The Raid is that it's like a kind of computer game where he's moving through this building and he's trying to get to the top to face the end boss. The fighting, the martial arts in the film is incredible. The sense of tempo. Everybody needs to watch The Raid at least once. I thought it was fantastic. And I actually believe that if The Raid had not been a kind of sleeper hit in 2011, John Wick probably would not have been made. I think The Raid is a very big influence on John Wick. Anyway, 69, Man with a Movie Camera, Trainspotting, About Schmidt, Revenge of the Sith, Performance, Zulu, Full Metal Jacket, Salesman, Freaks, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, This is England, Taxi Driver, Scum, Downfall, The Wolf of Wall Street, Kind Hearts and Coronets, The Birthday Party, Alice in Wonderland, The Wicker Man, Groundhog Day, King of Comedy, John Wick, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Space Odyssey, Metropolis, Blue Remembered Hills, Goodfellas, Eraserhead, and Pinocchio. And we are caught up. Are you ready for the top 40, ladies and gentlemen? Get ready. Okay. So, let's go. Oh, also, as per yesterday, I will stop at every 10 to read out any super chats that happen to have come in. I don't think there's been any so far. Maybe there will be soon. I don't think I've missed any. Okay. So, a lot of people are. And so the two films people were most unhappy about were Eraserhead, which is very artsy, I'll grant you, and lots of people don't like it, and The Cook, the Thief, the Wife, and Her Lover. Several people said, oh, that's a really arty, kind of pretentious film. What can you do? Sometimes an arts PhD is going to arts PhD, you know. And what else? One person said they're from South London and they really dislike Love, Honor and Obey. They think it's a ridiculous film, which is fair enough. All opinions are subjective. Only some are more correct than others. Okay, so let's get on with it. Number 40 is Sallow, or 120 Days of Sodom. Now, where to start with this? This is probably the most disgusting film you'll ever see. It is really revolting. And why is it on the list? I've only ever seen this film once. I've only ever seen it. I actually had to watch it in several stages because the person I was with walked out of the room. They were sick. We then had to pause it to have an argument about why I was bringing this filth into the, this was my, I guess Mrs. AA1, we could call her but anyway, we had a row because I was like, why are you making me watch this rubbish? I still ended up watching it all. The thing is, the thing is about Sallow is that when I watched it, I felt tainted. It stayed with me. It haunted me. It almost polluted my brain. And for weeks on end afterwards, I was thinking, what is this film about? I was working at the time in the city, and I was producing an event that was in Chicago. And all of my other colleagues, they were up on this very trendy bar, drinking cocktails, looking over that big egg thing. And, we were all in suits and it was all cool and stuff. And I thought, listen, I can't stop thinking about Sallow. So I went to the New York Public I went to the Chicago Public Library while everybody else was having drinks to get all the books I could about Pasolini and about this film to see what on earth critics say about it. Why is it so rated? What is it trying to say? If people don't know the setup, there are these four libertines. It's kind of set in kind of fascist. It was like a kind of rump state left over from Mussolini's Italy. Called Sallow, and these four libertines kidnap all of these young people, force them to strip down, as you can see, and they then commit all sorts of debauch, every sort of rape you can imagine, gratuitous acts of violence, shit eating, you name it, it's there, and the structure of it follows Dante's nine circles of hell, so they keep on kind of descending down and down as the film goes on. And even though you're watching all of this kind of gratuitous act, the film is actually really quite dull. It's really slow and boring, and you're kind of, it's you know, it's disgusting, but at the same time you're like nauseous with boredom watching this thing. It's a very strange experience to watch. And the reason, anyway, after all this reading around, I actually came to believe that Pasolini was trying to make a comment on, rather than making a comment on fascism, making a comment on bourgeois sensibilities and the idea of trying to make everything an aesthetic experience, trying to make everything, I don't know, pleasurable, but then becoming really kind of, I guess you could say, anal about your pleasure or anal about the aesthetic experience. And then this will to, shall we say, rank everything, to codify, to... I think this is what the film is getting at. It's getting at this will to try to impose order on that which is aesthetic, which obviously, as somebody making a top 100 list, is kind of an interesting thought. Yes, if the one of the interesting things about Salo is that the libertines, even though they're having all of these experiences, they're trying to push it to the limit, they're trying to get to the next hit, they're up against, you know, the law of diminishing marginal returns. You know, the more extreme they get, the less they're getting out of this. You know, they're trying to savor the differences between all these different varieties of extremity, and yet they're not really feeling anything. The joy of it is almost sucked out of it because they're trying to impose so much order on everything. So that's what I think Salo is about. It's almost a comment on, I guess you'd say, consumerist society, that this is what, you know, when you think of the YouTube videos of the kid with the opening the Star Wars box, or of the, you know, the meme some people make, you know, don't ask questions, just consume. You know, these are kind of overgrown children who are just kind of talking about what are they being served? What is the product that they're consuming? You know, it's more and more. I mean, it's literally in some cases shit. So I think this is what Salo is trying to get at. But I won't linger anymore. I think every serious film fan should watch it once. Lots of people will disagree and just say it's pretentious rubbish. Other people will just say it's trying to be shocking for its own sake. But I'm in the camp that thinks it's important. Not that I dig it out very often, it has to be said. It's one of those ones where you watch it once and I think that's it forever. But once was enough. Number 39, another disturbing film, I guess you could say, is Old Boy. Now, one of the types of films I like films that are, as I mentioned, a duel of wits, a duel between two different wills. And Old Boy, not only is it a classic revenge film, but it is also how far are these two men going to push each other, and who's going to break first? Now this guy here, I think his name's Evergreen in the cast list. He is a contender for one of the worst villains in any film. I mean, he is a horrible, horrible person, right up there with Chad from In the Company of Men, and probably the libertines from Salo. You know, they'd be on the villains list too. But this guy is, I mean, I don't think it gives too much away, but it starts with the other guy, the old boy. He's had him abducted and kept in solitary for 15 years. And he almost, like, he kind of keeps him in bad conditions and things. And essentially the film is a revenge mission after he gets out. It's tremendous. I mean, again, really quite sick, but it's got a visceral pace and an energy. It's quite an exhilarating film, I think, Old Boy, and really some really some very haunting scenes that will stay for you. And Old Boy, unlike Solo, is not so disturbing that you wouldn't watch it more than once. So I very highly rate Old Boy. Fantastic film. Let's keep on going, because number 38 is The Lord of the Rings. Now, I've cheated a little bit by making them all one film, because I am of the opinion that the way to watch Lord of the Rings is to get the special extended box set with all of the extra stuff put back in and to watch it all in a one like 13 hour sitting, which every once in a while I'll try to do. Every once in a while I'll try to do the marathon, the Lord of the Rings marathon. And you could do it in a day if you pace yourself and you can plan meals around it and things. And it's a really quite, I mean, you see how good the films are if you watch them all in one day. Now, I actually happened to do the same thing with The Hobbit, because a cinema near me, when the third Hobbit came out, they did an all-night thing where you'd watch the first two, and then as the premiere hit at midnight, you'd watch the new one. Hobbit, unfortunately, works nowhere near as well, and is far inferior as a trilogy of films. But Lord of the Rings, I think, is probably as good as it gets for a book adaptation, bringing a well-loved story to life. Now, purists will say, oh, well, yeah, you know, but you'll never get to the Tolkien. But I actually disagree. I think every single cut made to Lord of the Rings was correct. You know, you read the books, there's all this poetry, Tom Bombadil and all this. Okay, get lost. Come on. Get to the... So I think Lord of the Rings does a superb job of what it is. I also think that the core stories, you know, the story of Sam and Frodo there, the story of Gollum, the you know, Aragorn's quest, the Legolas and Gimli, Gandalf's story, of course, what's going on with Saruman, every single part of it works as a kind of narrative in its own right. Truly epic, epic cinema. One of my all-time highlights as a film fan was going to watch The Two Towers when it came out in 2002 and seeing that battle at the end. What is it? What's the battle called? At the end of Two Towers. Is it the Battle of... Helm's Deep, that's the one. And I mean, coming out of the cinema, I was just in a daze. I was in a daze for like a day later. That was the best battle scene I'd ever seen in anything. It was so epic, it was so incredible. Return of the King, I mean, when it came out, everybody felt it went on a bit too long. You know, it feels like it ends about 15 times. But if you do the special extended 13-hour all-in-one-day thing, you will understand why it ends so many times, because it kind of needs to pay off all of the different things that you've just witnessed. So it really is, I think it's a tremendous work. You know, they film them back to back. In many ways, the legacy of Lord of the Rings hasn't been very good for cinema. You know, they made all of these knockoff epic films after then. They, you know, gave studios the idea of like coming out with a franchise. We're going to make a franchise and we're going to do everything back to back. And so all of those things, yes, they've been harmful. But Lord of the Rings itself, I think, is tremendous. Also, politically speaking, I think it's fundamentally a conservative text. You know, the Shire, the love of the home, the fact they're trying to get back, it has built in, there's a fear of the outsider there, I guess you want to put it that way. A kind of suspicion of modernity. So all of those things are there, you know, in the original Tolkien, and probably Peter Jackson's just like, even though I know the writers were kind of leftists and so on, they just weren't in, you know, at that point, they weren't really thinking along those lines. So there it is. So Yeah, Saffron's saying a return to tradition. Yeah, I don't see any reason why Lord of the Rings shouldn't be held up as a great kind of traditional. It, I mean, Tolkien is getting back to pre-modern values. And by pre-modern, I mean like before Shakespeare, before the kind of text that started to ask questions of the medieval world order. He's harking back to, you know, not just the kind of ancient Greek epics, but stuff like Beowulf and the heroism of those, you know, where we're thinking in terms of archetypes as opposed to the individual and things like that. So, yeah, Lord of the Rings, I still rate it very highly. I'm sure everybody else has got many views on this, but let's keep on going. So number 37, another tremendous film. I'm All Right, Jack. Classic Bolting Brothers comedy from the late 50s. This was at a time when the unions were causing a lot of trouble in Britain. And the ultimate anti-union film is I'm All Right, Jack, featuring probably one of his career best performances from Peter Sellers as the kind of pseudo-intellectual. You know, he captures the union guy so well in the film, where, you know, he's kind of lower middle class. He's read a little bit of Marx. He fancies himself as a bit of an intellectual. Yeah, really, really good film. Also an interesting look at how self-interested and selfish human beings are. It doesn't just have a go at the unions. It has a go at everybody. And this is so it's kind of an interestingly anti-establishment film as well, because the whole idea is that the unions and the company bosses are kind of in cahoots. They kind of engineer a general strike situation because they each have these vested interests. So yeah, I'm All Right, Jack, absolutely top-notch movie. If you haven't seen it, you should do so at once. So good on the union stuff. Yep. One of my favorites. I'll keep on going. Now we'll really get into the business end. Now these are films that I just love all the way around. And so if you remember last time I said Love, Honor and Bay was my pick of my favorite kind of British gangster films of that crop that came out around the time of the Guy Ritchie movies. Now I was not including in that Sexy Beast because it's a different type of film really. But Sexy Beast, Ray Winstone is in Sexy Beast, but the film is all about the central performance of Ben Kingsley, who is absolutely phenomenal as this chap here, Don Logan. I mean, I've talked about bullies quite a lot. He's probably the ultimate bully in a film. His rants are insane. There's something hypnotic about the way he goes on. You know, do you know what I mean? Idi Amin and all this sort of stuff. Amazing film, Sexy Beast. I love the way it starts with Ray Winstone on the beach and, you know, sitting on the beaches, looking at the peaches. Sexy Beast is fantastic. Did he win an Oscar for it? I want to say Ben Kingsley may have won an Oscar for this role. Certainly he should have been nominated. I mean, if he didn't, he should have won it. One of the things I realized looking through the list is that you get certain years which seem to have a lot of good films. The year 2000, a lot of good films. You know, Sexy Beast, Love, Honor and Obey. I seem to remember Gladiator came out in the year 2000. Lots of decent movies came out in that year. So there we go. So let's keep on going. Somebody said this film annoyed me. I wanted to punch Gandhi. Well, that's the idea. I mean, he's basically kind of, he is relentless. He is irritating. He's waspish. He's, you know, he's almost like a force of evil. He's almost like the devil incarnate in this film. And his breaking down of the Ray Winstone character, because he basically wants the Ray Winstone character to come out of retirement and he won't do it. And he's like, you will. He's trying to break him down. And there are moments where he just starts like shouting, you know, at one point he shouts, What is it? Yes, Roundtree. Yes, you will. Friday, be there. Yes, yes, yes. And then there's another rant that he goes on where he starts shouting no, no, no a lot as well. So I just basically love the film for that reason. So let's keep on going. So number 35, another Stone Cold classic, The Seventh Seal from 1957. I really like Ingmar Bergman, kind of dour Swedish director. A lot of these kind of, brooding Swedish films. But one of the best of them is The Seventh Seal, in which Death, as you can see him there, the Grim Reaper, comes for this knight, and the knight tries to bargain for his life, and they say, let's have a game of chess, and if I can beat Death at chess, Death says, well, you can live, basically, but of course you cannot cheat Death. Brilliant film. It's set in the kind of medieval era during the plague, you know, during the Black Death, many interesting scenes, a meditation on faith. People who are religious, I think, would have a lot of interesting things to say about The Seventh Seal. Serious film, but also just cool. It's just cool. You know, it's Death playing chess. I mean, what can you say? So let's keep on going. Number 34, kind of a student. Back in my student days, everybody loved this film, but I think a lot of students love With Nail and I, because there used to be a game where you know try to keep up with Richard E. Grant's drinking in With Nail and I. There are these two guys. They go and stay in a cottage in the countryside, and they've got a kind of fat gay uncle, I seem to remember. Screenplay is amazing. The performance from Richard E. Grant is fantastic. Earlier on, I posted as a reply to Mark a speech from Hamlet. You know, oh, what a piece of work is a man, how infinite in reason, how infinite in faculty. Well, that is the speech that he keeps on reciting in With Nail and I, because he's an out of work actor. I love many aspects of the film. I like how grotty their place is. You know, they haven't done the washing up. He kind of like neglects himself. He's a bitter character. There are some just amazing moments. There's one moment where he just looks up and he says, "I demand some booze." That was always a favorite when we were students. So everybody should watch With Nail and I, especially if you're currently in university. I would say absolutely essential viewing, you know, in your student days, but even subsequently. It's just a very, very good film, and a great I guess you'd call it a black comedy. Yeah. So Mitch is saying, is he a bully? Yes, he is a bully. Is it dark? Now, you see, you're trying to lure me. You're trying to bait me. I'm not going to say it. let's carry on. Let's carry on going. I really do. Somebody said it's like Bottom with posh accents. Yes, it is. It is. It is. It's like, I mean, oh, but also I love the kind of decrepitude of everything. Not just in their place, but when they go down to, is it Uncle Monty? Is that his name? When they go down to that cottage and it's all a bit kind of disheveled and disused. And I love the idea of dereliction. I like seeing derelict buildings and things. Like I call it derelict in honor of Zoolander. And there's a lot of that in this film as well. And it kind of, I guess you'd call it pathetic fallacy. It reflects the what is in Richard E. Grant character's heart is being reflected in his external surroundings. So I guess you'd call that pathetic fallacy. So let's keep on going, because number 33, of course, I love the smell of napalm in the morning, is Apocalypse Now. by Francis Ford Coppola. Fantastic film. Now, I'm actually not sure about what the normal version of Apocalypse Now is, because there was a release called Apocalypse Now Redux, where they brought it out again and they put a lot of deleted scenes back in. It was like a special extended one. And I saw it for the very first time in the cinema when that was released. And that is the version that I know. So I don't know if I want to say there are long extended sequences of French people talking about politics in that version. If that isn't in the normal one, then maybe that's what they cut out. But I actually love those scenes with the French. You know, it's so it's probably one of the best bits of comments on the French mindset is just that little politics discussion they have in the middle of it. The other thing I love about Apocalypse Now is that you forget who's in it. You forget the House of Ford crops up at the start, for example. And there are all these different bits, and Marlon Brando's in it and Dennis Hopper's in it and Robert Duvall is in it. And it's all like different bits and it's kind of epic. I really like Apocalypse Now. Of course, it's based on the Joseph Conrad novel Heart of Darkness, although it's they relocated it to Vietnam. And it asks all sorts of interesting questions about war, about colonialism, about all sorts of different things. And it's just cool. I think it's just a cool film. So yeah, Apocalypse Now. Some people are saying that it's a bit boring, but I don't know. I don't think it's boring. I think it's really good. So let's keep on going. We're on quite a decent kick now, because number 32 is Woody Allen's finest moment, Annie Hall. Every once in a while, you get actors who are born to play parts. And I think Diana Keaton was pretty much born to play Annie Hall. Really a very good romantic comedy, I guess, with all sorts of interesting little kind of clever touches from Woody Allen. You know, there's famously a scene where he's queuing up to the cinema and there's this critic talking about the thing they're going to see, and the actual the writer is there and he goes and corrects the cricket the critic, and Woody Allen talks directly to the camera. There are all sorts of cool things. Now, is this the film that Woody Allen is that Christopher Walken is in as like his brother, or is that Manhattan? I always get confused between Christopher Walken crops up in one of these films as well. I want to say it's this one. I just really like, it's a kind of really, all of Woody Allen's films kind of love New York and the kind of feeling of being in a city, and yes, it's a very good film. I thought this is the one with Christopher Walken in it. All of the bits with him in it are amazing. You forget how funny Christopher Walken can be a lot of the time. So Annie Hall, fantastic movie. Whatever you make of Woody Allen, I don't think you could take away the fact this is probably one of the best, if not the best, romantic comedy ever made. I love it. Special place in my heart. And we're getting up now to the point where all of these films are kind of special in some way to me, because this is a very personal film, this. So there we go. So let's keep on going. Number 31 is Time Bandits. One of the reasons it's Time Bandits is for the performance of this man here, David Warner. Some video game fans will know him from Baldur's Gate 2, where he plays John Irenicus. Got one of the coolest voices of any person ever. I love him as Irenicus. I also love him here. I think his character is just called Evil Genius. He's also in the animated Batman. He plays Ra's al Ghul in that. But anyway, David Warner, always worth seeing in anything he's in, especially when he's a bad guy. But aside from Warner, Time Bandits is really underrated. Now, people talk about Terry Gilliam. They always talk about Brazil. I think Time Bandits really is overlooked in his pantheon. I haven't ranked Brazil. He's got another film as well. They kind of form a trilogy. It's called The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. I was thinking about including that as well. It didn't quite make the cut, but that's very well worth seeking out too. It's a little bit disjointed, but I kind of enjoy Baron Munchausen. You know, there were some scenes which were creepy to watch as a kid with the Angel of Death in them, for example. And Jonathan Pryce is in that, as he is in Brazil. But anyway, Time Bandits, well worth watching. It's got this young boy in it. His, you know, there's some weird comments on consumerism and how, brainless television is rotting people's brain, you know, people's minds. His parents are so detached and so weird. You know, they're just watching this awful stuff on television. And then this young boy who's yearning for just some life, something, some escape, some adventure. He goes on this amazing journey with these little dwarves and meets Sean Connery and John Cleese and all these people along the way. It's a fun film, great adventure film, great kind of fantasy movie, but at the same time, it explores a lot of those interesting themes of, like, what is the heart of your culture giving you? And clearly it's not doing it for this young lad. Also, God makes an appearance in it as this kind of floating head because he wants his map back. And there are lots of interesting things between evil genius and God, because evil genius, he's kind of, it's like a bit Paradise Lost, like, I guess. It's like Satan asking questions of God. It's interesting. I also love the set designs in it. You know, everything's wrapped in plastic, and so I like Time Bandits, and it's probably my favorite Terry Gilliam movie. Also, John Cleese as Robin Hood is very funny. He plays Robin Hood as a kind of like royal, like meeting. It's almost like a member of the royal family. Sean Connery is cool in the film as a kind of, I think they go to like mythical ancient Greece or something. He fights a cyclops, I seem to remember. All sorts of things happen in it. Really good. So let's maybe I'll go to super chats now, and when I come back, we'll do more. Just gonna have a little puff on this cigar. Yeah, Robin Hood. And you're a robber too. How long have you been a robber, Wally? About 4 foot two. Okay, so let's have a look at super chats. Now, how do I get to super chats on the new, on the stupid new? Why do they keep on changing the layout of YouTube? Okay, now I've got it. I've sat to, I every time I go on YouTube, I switch it back to classic mode. All right, so here we are. Okay. So, I think Harian Gladiv says, this counts as my one stream ban, ? Oh, no, Harian. And you've got a one stream unpopular opinions ban. When I hand out bans, it's for unpopular opinions. And you, sir, have got one stream ban. Although I can't remember what for. What was that for? It's probably, he was being cheeky, being very cheeky. Jaws the Great and Powerful says, big fan of Salat. The Raid is a great showcase for the martial arts. Yes, I mean, it is tremendous. The Raid is just, I mean, I don't know what the best martial arts in a film is, but I would say it's surely between The Raid, Ip Man, and John Wick in terms of impressive fights. It's got to be between those three, hasn't it? Or at least those. I mean, I know there's a Raid 2, the sequels to Ip Man, and the sequels to John Wick as well. But I would say it's between those three series. You know, yeah, I've seen some of the old martial arts films and the Bruce Lees and all that, but they're not as hardcore as the fighting in those three films, I would say. So I think it's between those three. I mean, the Ip Man is insane in terms of what he can do, but the guy in The Raid is pretty amazing. I mean, the fighting in The Raid is next. I mean, they're all slightly different styles, aren't they? But then again, one of the things I don't know about John Wick, does Keanu Reeves do his own training? Because if he does, Keanu Reeves must be like in the one of the world's best martial artists at this point. I mean, how does he manage to do it? I don't know about that. So there we go. I mean, somebody's saying that Bruce Lee was a real martial artist, but okay, but surely the guy in The Raid is a real martial artist too, and surely the guy in Ip Man is a real one. I mean, surely those guys are actual martial artists. You can't do that stuff without it. Keanu Reeves in John Wick is a bit more of a kind of brawler. He's not like much of a finesse fighter. He's, you know, he's very rugged, I guess, so he doesn't do anything that is that kind of difficult, I guess. But the other two guys must be martial artists. I mean, so anyway, that's lots of people are saying it's called acting, it's called choreography. I mean, yeah, but you know, I couldn't do that. I mean, I maybe with enough training, if you gave me like 10 years or something, I doubt it though. Yeah, apparently Keanu Reeves did almost all his martial arts for The Matrix and John Wick. My God. And yes, the real Ip Man did train the young Bruce Lee. That's what he's famous for. Charlemagne says, I hope Empire of Dust made the list. No, Empire of Dust did not make the list, but it is a really good film. And an eye-opener as well. Classic. It's also tiresome. So let's keep on going. I'm very impressed that Keanu Reeves does all his own stuff in there, because some of that stuff is really quite something, I would say. Architect of Fate says, prediction number one is Highlander. There can be only one. Well, I mean, I can exclusively reveal Highlander did not make the list. I'm afraid. Sorry about that. Pseudonym says, even Salo doesn't approve of a pig in a thong. Yeah, I mean, the Libertines never at any point bring any pigs into the action. So the Britisher is probably more Libertine than the four Libertines in Salo. Damascus Steel says, on Salo, every time a film or opera adds the bourgeois or political critique on things, I tend to find it loses a lot of edge. Same is true with more modern renditions of things like the opera Salome. Okay. Oh, so you think that Salo loses its edge because it's because of I mean, I don't know. I could be. Yeah. So let me know if you think Salo has lost its edge for that reason. Silly Sailor says, there's far too much fawning over these Hollywood types in this award show. Didn't you learn anything from Ricky Gervais's Golden Globes? Happy New Year. Oh, yeah. I mean, the Ricky Gervais speech was absolutely amazing at the Golden Globes. Yeah, absolutely. Samson Agonisti says, unrelated to the stream, because I rarely catch you live, but was the book about all the experts shilling for the UK to join the Euro? What was the book? Oh, that book was by Peter O'Born. And it was called, the name is, if you just type into Google, Peter O'Born Euro book, or Peter, that you'll find it. That's the one. Samson, Jaws the Great and Powerful says, Google Donnie Yen Hong Kong nightclub. Okay, people can go and do that. Charlemagne says, Keanu does the training, watch the special features. Great. And Greed the Avaricious says, if Dark Crystal is not on the list, I'm going to make Skeksis Chamberlain noises. Skeksis Chamberlain noises. Labyrinth better be number one, knowing it's you doing this list. I'm afraid the Dark Crystal is not on the list. And one of the reasons is because I rewatched it recently before the Netflix series starts. And I still haven't, I've only been 20 minutes. And I started to watch the Netflix series twice. And I only got 20 minutes in each time. Once because I was with my parents and my, my parents were talking. My mother wouldn't settle down and things. And the other time is because I was with Mrs. AA and she was moaning. And she was like, oh, I was like, look, I'm going to have to do this another time. And I haven't managed to come back to the Dark Crystal Netflix series. But my criticism of the Dark Crystal, even though the Skeksis are amazing and Chamberlain is amazing and all the rest of it, it is quite a slow, dull film. And it's quite... I always think the Dark Crystal is quite straight-laced. And it's a like high fantasy played dead straight. You don't see that very often. And it's commendable for it. But a little bit too dry, I think, for a top 100 list, for my personal top 100 list. Not saying that you shouldn't put it on yours. Okay, so with all that said, why don't we carry on? And I do, don't get me wrong, I do like and rate The Dark Crystal, just not quite on the top 100. All right, so let's keep on going. Number 30 is American Beauty. Now, I can see some people rolling their eyes already. How can you put something like this on the list? But I think American Beauty is a fantastic film. One of the things that's really good for, it's good in many, many different ways. So even though Sam Mendes was the director, the real star of the direction was the director of photography for the movie. The name escapes me now, but the director of photography, but anyway, the camera work is amazing in American Beauty. I mean, some people are saying unsubscribe. I think American Beauty asks a lot of interesting questions about the modern world, and some people say that Black Pill is not going to be happy. I'm not sure about that. I think there are aspects of the film that you could appreciate from the from a reactionary angle. Hear me out here. So yes, the film is essentially about Kevin Spacey's character here, Lester Burnham, going through a midlife crisis and basically kind of living out his kind of boomer midlife crisis. Okay. And he's got this very highly strung wife who goes and kind of cuckolds him with this with the king. You know, this is what it feels to be nailed by the king. You know, who's this kind of sleazy sales guy with amazing silver fox hair and dark eyebrows, which is always a look I like. The acting in the film is fantastic. The script is really good. The secondary performances in the film are really good. You know, there's the couple living across the road, and the older guy is like the army sergeant who's and I know Black Pill didn't like the film because there are these kind of homoerotic undertones, and because the guy is right wing, he's secretly gay under it and all the rest of it. I don't think that any of that stuff is important. His wife, so his performance, Chris Cooper's performance, is really good, but the wife, who has basically a silent role in the film, is really good. I mean, that's one of the best like mute performances in a film I can remember. And then you have the young boy and the kids. A lot of American Beauty is trying to get at this idea that there must be something more. You know, so yes, okay, all those things Black Pill said, but think about what those guys always talk about. There must be something more to life than the material. I mean, that's what American Beauty is about. It's trying to get at some meaning in life that is more than. That's why they keep on following that like plastic bag around. They're trying to find something more, some immaterial beauty, something beyond all of these things that aren't making these people happy. You know, this couple have everything. You know, they're trying to get down where, you know, they're trying to reignite some passion in their relationship, and oh, she's worried about he's going to spill wine on the sofa or whatever. So I actually think that American Beauty is unfairly written off because of the black-pilled review of it. I still think it's a good film. I think it's worth watching. And I think it's technically excellent in every department. Acting is probably the best Kevin Spacey performance ever. Annette Bening is really good in it. All of the secondary performances are excellent. The script is good. The cinematography is amazing. You know, Sam Mendes was there, you know, so all of those things. So people are saying I'm a wet, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know. So let's keep on going. Everybody says it's I don't know why this is such an unpopular pick, but I'm going to stick with it. So number 29 is Michael Haneke's Funny Games. So if you remember, one of my picks was The Birthday Party, the William Friedkin film. Funny Games has got the same idea, basically. These two strangers come and they want to terrorize this family. And it's fun to watch the it's not fun. It's pretty sinister, really. They come and they basically torture and make life hell for this couple. One of the interesting things about Funny Games is that Haneke pulls away. He doesn't show you the violence. Whenever there's anything gratuitous going on, the camera pans away. You can hear what's happening, but you're watching like the wall or something. So a lot of what happens in the film plays out in your own imagination. And there's probably some a comment about, you know, the nature of violence or something going on. He was probably like, I think Haneke, I imagine Haneke is quite a leftist filmmaker. So he was probably trying to say something about how we consume violence, especially in that moment in the 90s where Tarantino was making his splash and all the rest of it. But I think Funny Games is a very interesting film. So I'll just leave it there. So let's keep on going. Number 28 is Deliverance from 1972. John Moore, Borman. Very interesting look at certain parts of the Deep South. Now, I know a lot of people from down south in America, but I can imagine some people would say, oh, well, this is clearly demonizing the South. It's demonizing demonizing the Southern man in a way that probably like Django Unchained does in a way as well, like if the way that that's depicted. But I don't care about all that. What I care about is you get these remote areas in some of these films, and the sorts of grotesque, strange people you meet in these remote towns. This is a fascinating thing to see on screen, and Deliverance is one of the ultimate films for it. It's got some very famous, I can see some people saying squeal like a pig, indeed. Dueling banjos. Some people are saying everything you like is anti-white. Well, I mean, the thing is that, maybe some of these things are there, but this is still a good film. Like, regardless of some of those other things, Deliverance is just a really good film. It's got a lot of memorable moments, and it's and it stays with you, and it's fun as well. I think it's fun. I think it's a lot. It's kind of crazy film, it's one of those things that if you caught it on TV, it'd start, and then as it went on, it would start surprising you with how extreme and kind of like what ends up happening in it. Okay, so Let's keep on going then. Philo Mattis says, I literally live where Deliverance was filmed. Now, do you think that the filmmakers were unfair on the residents of that town? Do you think it was anti kind of Southern man, this film? Like anti Southern propaganda by Yankee Doodles? Let's have a look. No, he doesn't. So there we go. There you go. So let's keep on going. Because number 27, speaking of remote areas with really interesting locations and so on, No Country for Old Men. And you know, I was saying about how 2000 was a great year for films. 2007 was an absolutely barnstorming year. I mean, so many great films came out in 2007. And I remember No Country for Old Men was one of them. Really good film. You know, Javier Bardem was great as the kind of sinister, slightly autist villain. One of the interesting things about him is that he's, remember I was saying about like some people are just evil, they just do bad things because they like to do bad things. Now I like that in films because it cuts against liberal narratives, it cuts against the leftist vision of the world. And there it is, right in the heart of No Country for Old Men. This guy is not reformable. He's not. You can stick this guy in prison and it's not going to matter because he is doing these things for his own reasons. And he's not going to apologize for it. And up against that, the only justice you can have is rough justice. It has to be hard, you know, not restorative or rehabilitative justice, but, retribution. Hard justice is required. You know, he's forced to meet a guy like this. Another thing I like about the film is the sense of tiredness of the Tommy Lee Jones character, the world weariness, the expansive open spaces. I think, for me, the best Coen Brothers movie. I went through a stretch of watching every single Coen. I watched every single Coen Brothers movie in order from Blood Simple onwards, and I actually think they're pretty overrated, if I'm honest. I'm not a huge fan of some of their other works. I like Blood Simple. Blood Simple's really good, and it was kind of in the conversation when I was making the very long list, and I cut it down to 100, and Blood Simple was on that longer list, but it ended up getting cut. But No Country for Old Men, for me, is their best film by a long way. Really good. There are lots of other interesting things that happen in it. The shootouts and the chases and so on are tense. They get you into it. Kind of philosophically interesting. I don't know. I like the film a lot. And like I said, the Bardem character, I think he's just not you cannot absorb him into ready-made kind of Hollywood leftist narratives, and that's one of the reasons I really like him as a villain. So there we go. Somebody's saying Barton thing. I'm thinking of the other Coen Brothers movies. Barton Fink is good. Barton Fink is worth watching. I don't like Big Lebowski. I don't like, I think it's a well overrated film. I don't like, not that keen on, what was that one with George Clooney in it? You know, everybody went on about it for a while. I can't even remember the name of it. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? I mean, that's got a great soundtrack, but it's not like as a film, I can take it or leave it, to be honest. The Coens are weird. They seem like they should be better than they are, but one of my issues with the Coen brothers, other works, not this one, this is really good, is that they seem like they lose focus, and lots of their films feel like you're two-thirds away through and they've lost interest in it, and the films become unfocused and they drift and they kind of peter out. That was my issue with a lot of the Coen Brothers movies, is that they're indisciplined and they lose focus. So that's my comment there. Now, if you just excuse me a second, my PC is not actually plugged in and I'm going to run out of battery. So give me one second. Okay. Oh dear, I haven't got the plug. What am I going to do? Yeah. Oh, there it is. Okay. There it is. It had come out of the adapter. That was the issue. So let me carry on then. All right. So No Country for Old Men. Great film. Now, interestingly, when this won the Best Picture at the 2007 Oscars, back when the Oscars were worth watching because there were so many good films out, I remember being quite disappointed that it won, because I didn't think it deserved to win that year, which is a spoiler for another film from 2007 that I think deserved to win that year instead. So let's keep on going, because number 26 is Dr. Strangelove. It's directed by Stanley Kubrick, classic political black comedy, three tremendous performances from Peter Sellers, not only as Dr. Strangelove, but as the British Army officer and the kind of LBJ president figure as well. So many amazing moments, general played by Sterling Hayden. You know, my vital essences, the massive cigar he smokes. I really like Dr. Strangelove, Cowboy on the Bomb, all the rest of it. So, one of the things I like about Kubrick films is how, there seems to be a kind of intensity of focus where the camera just kind of stays on a situation. It always feels like it lingers a little bit too long. And I like that kind of it's a slightly obsessive quality that Kubrick's lens has. And it's in all his films. And that's something else I like about Dr. Strangelove as well. And it's funny. I think it's a funny film. So let's keep on going, because number 25 is Brian De Palma's Scarface, an absolutely mental film. I was fortunate because I got to see this in the cinema as well. It was already a film I'd seen many times, but when they gave a limited re-release and they were showing it in some cinemas in London, and I got to see Scarface on the big screen. So that was a treat. I love Al Pacino, especially when he's in over the top mode, and nothing exceeds like excess as the world is yours. And Scarface is the ultimate 80s excess movie. You know, the Thatcher Reagan era. Capitalism seemed like it was spiraling. I mean, I don't really care if De Palma had any like anti-capitalist, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I don't really care, because the film it's just so gloriously over the top. It's got loads of great lines from the Oliver Stone script. America's one big pussy waiting to be fucked is one of the famous lines. The whole thing when he's in the Pelican, the whole the bad guys, this is the last time you'll see a bad guy like this again. I love all the sleazy characters in it. The big boss, you know, come here, you little monkey, and all this sort of stuff. Yeah, it's just great. It's just great. And the central performance of Pacino, tremendous, like, iconic. Nothing else you can say about it, really. It's quite a long film, and there are obviously scenes of gratuitous violence and chainsaws and all the rest of it. But I think it needs to be. It needs to be excessive, you know. Yeah, I love Scarface. So let's keep on going then, because number 24, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Now this is a difficult film, I think. Jim Carrey in one of his straight roles. I think it's really good. If anybody's ever been in a long-term relationship and you know, is split up and they want to get over it, I wouldn't recommend watching Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, because it will probably gut you. The whole setup of the film is that he's had this relationship with the Kate Winslet character there, and he goes to this therapist and basically they're going to remove his memories of this entire relationship to help him get over it. And then you watch all of these scenes which are taking place in his memory, and then as you're watching them, the memory wipe is coming. It's really, I mean, it's kind of high concept, but I really thought The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind was a very interesting film, with how it deals with memory, how it deals with narratives. You know, did this happen or didn't this happen? How it deals with who, you know, how much of memory is who we are, and also how it deals with the relationship, and how much of the relationship is the little narrative that you build together. And once you destroy that, what happens? You know, and having been divorced once after a very long relationship, obviously this would, I don't know, I haven't watched it since then, so I mean, you know, maybe it'd be difficult to watch after that. But even before then, I remember really thinking this was a very interesting film. So I will carry on. Yeah, very good film indeed. Unironically, every once in a while, you know, mainstream movies can surprise you, I guess. I mean, I'm guessing this was an indie film. Elijah Wood is in it randomly. He's quite a kind of a horrible character in the film, Elijah Wood. Eternal Sunshine. But not recommended if you're getting over a relationship, I will say that. It will probably, like, end you if you're already upset. So I would watch it. I would actually watch it when you're in a happy relationship already, rather than if you're trying to get over something, because it's it really is quite devastating if you've ever loved anyone. So number 23 is Fanny and Alexander, the Ingmar Bergman film. Now this is a very long film. I think if you watched it all at once, it's about 5 hours long. And it was turned into a TV series, and maybe you could watch it almost as individual episodes of a TV. Really interesting, heartwarming film in parts, existentially, kind of an existential film. All of Bergman's films are about angst, and they're about faith, and they're about what life is about. Anybody who's religious, anybody who has faith at all, probably would get a lot out of watching a film like Fanny Alexander. For a long time, I used to say that Fanny Alexander was my number one film, because it's very profound. It's a deep, mature work by a great director. These days, I've only put it here at 23 because I'm less pretentious than I was, I guess. But it's still absolutely top notch. And again, this if this was me doing my kind of Sight and Sound top 100 as opposed to my personal favorite list, this would go a lot higher, you know, because objectively speaking, it's a tremendous piece of work. So let's keep on going then, because number 22 is Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. A film I've seen hundreds of times, childhood favorite, but also a really good film because under the surface, it is, I can't use the D word. What can I say? It's not dark. It's, I mean, all right, there's a grim morality tale there in the Roald Dahl source material where Wonka is teaching these kids or their parents a lesson. So there's a very sharp streak of kind of strict moralism, because all of these kids are horrible and they need to be taught a lesson, basically. So that's that part of it is good. But the thing that makes Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory are the performances involved. Now, we've talked on this channel before about how problematic Grandpa Joe is. Okay, Grandpa Joe is an absolute scumbag. He is a freeloader. He's been in bed for 20 years and he suddenly comes alive. Let's leave that aside and talk about some of the other aspects of the film. One is the performance of Wilder himself. Wilder is so good as Willy Wonka. He is mysterious. He is kind of unknowable. He's a little bit sinister. What I really like about the performance is how indifferent he is to the suffering and the feelings of all the people around him. There's a moment where Augustus Gloop falls in the river. He's completely unconcerned. He doesn't care at all. I kind of like that edge to the way that Wilder plays him. He's like, well, if this kid drowned, he wouldn't care. He'd care more about the chocolate than he would about the death of the child. That edginess makes this particular Wonka character interesting. I mean, he's basically sociopathic. There's the kind of trippy, the trippy, weird, what do they go on? A boat, the boat ride that they go on, and there's the chicken's head being lopped off and stuff. But it's all the way through. It's the whole performance. And then, of course, the amazing scene at the end where he's like, you stole fizzy lifting drinks. So you're not going to, you get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir. So that's, he's just amazing performance from Gene Wilder. But then there's all the other people in the film as well. One of the great performances in the film is Veruca Salt. The actress who plays her. She is a great spoiled child. And then her father, Mr. Salt, one of my favorite actors who crops up in like old Hammer horror films and basically loads of British movies. His name was Roy Kinnear. He is tremendous. He's like on career best form as Mr. Salt. Veruca, darling. Amazing performance. I like the guy in the candy store. The slightly creepy, the Candyman at the start. One of the great performances of all time in any film, it's only a small part, is the teacher. It's the teacher at the start. He's teaching the percentages and he's like, how many chocolate bars did you open? And then he asked Charlie, how many did you open? Two. He's like, two? I can't do two. And so he pretends he opened 200 chocolate. I love the Wonka teacher. Great, arrogant teacher. One of my all-time heroes. Willy Wonka, tremendous film. I really like it. Another thing I like about Wonka is that it was clearly like a low budget. It was clearly like a B movie, almost like a straight to video. It's clearly nobody making it at the time thought it would become a cult classic and watched afterwards. And I like that kind of slightly low rent quality to the whole thing as well. And some of the little bits they added, the Slugworth character and the intrigue around it. Great. Yeah, really good film. It's just wonderful. Just an absolutely wonderful film. And, they remade it, didn't they? They made the one with Johnny Depp, which was an absolute disaster. Disaster Zone. So so anyway, yes. And I'd also love to have one of those machines, which, you know, the good egg, the bad egg. I'd quite like to have one of those. One of my questions about it, though, is that when Vrook Assault is singing his song, one of the things she asks for is a bean feast. Now, what on earth is a bean feast? She says, I want a feast. I want a bean feast. Never understood what a bean feast is. So let's carry on, shall we? Yep. Because number 21 is Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Another film set in the remote deep south, obviously in Texas. I actually went to Texas once, and it genuinely does have bits which are creepy. I went to this ghost town called Glen Rio once, and it was it reminded me of a Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I remember the sign coming into Texas. It was like Texas. And it had these three burnt out chairs. It was literally like something out of a horror movie. And there, in this place in Glen, this ghost town, there was like a skull in the yard, like a cow skull, and, you know, the baking sun, and nobody was there. And then in the corner of my eye, saw a little flickering TV coming in from one of the rooms. And there was one guy living on his own in the ghost town. Oh, I never scarp as quickly in all my life. That was genuinely scary. But anyway, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, absolutely stone cold classic horror film. It's visceral. It's like a trip from start to finish. It's like going on a thrill ride. Genuinely scary in parts. You know, it's not just Leatherface. It's this whole creepy family. And the weird people they meet on the way, and the kind of naivety of the kids. I really like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Obviously, I've rated it as number 21. So let's have a quick pause for super chats. Hopefully, I haven't triggered too many people by some of these rankings. American Beauty was very unpopular, I have to say. I mean, it's not that bad. Come on. Jaws the Great and Powerful says, I kind of want to duck out and watch Hitman. Damn it, AA. Well, you can always come back and watch it later. But I'd prefer it if you stuck around and sent me super chats. Tragic Vision says, Banjo scare me just because of that film. Funny thing about banjos is that, you know, the comedian Frank Skinner, he is very big on banjos. And he actually got me into like a bit of banjo music because I used to listen to his radio show. I stole Get Out from Frank Skinner because he always used to say at the end of his radio show, and I kind of like it. So I took it for my channel. But Chris Primer says, Oh, brother, where art thou? Have you seen it? Yes. Like I said, the soundtrack is really good. I love the old kind of prison songs and the 1920s Lead Belly and Delta Blues and all that sort of stuff. That's tremendous. But as for the film, I could leave it. Federal Reserve has committed treason says, 1, 2 Girls and 1 Cup, best movie ever. I haven't seen 2 Girls and 1 Cup. What is it? It sounds like a porn movie or something. So all right. Shall we carry on then, folks? Because it's time for the top 20. Are we ready? Let's do it. Number 20 is The Godfather. Now, The Godfather is an amazing film. Obviously, everybody knows that. In fact, it was so good that when I first watched it when I was a teenager, I was so into it that when I came out, I almost thought I was in that, you know, I was trying to recreate bits of it myself, you know, LARPing as a gangster at the time. I absolutely loved it. It's one of those things that every time you watch it, you'll see something new in it. You'll see something different in it. obviously the acting is tremendous, you know, not just Brando, but it's Pacino and James Caan, and everybody in the movie is amazing. The actual story itself is interesting because it's a almost follows the plot of King Lear. You know, you've got this father who wants to give away his kingdom, and he's got these obviously in King Lear he's got three daughters, but in The Godfather he's got three sons. Who is he going to leave the kingdom to? Obviously, you know, there's a spot where James Caan's character tries to take over, and there's the whole sequence where Pacino goes to Italy, and there's Frido, of course. Just really good. Don't know what much more to say about The Godfather. So many memorable moments. One of my all-time favorite scenes in any movie is the scene near the end where Michael, you know, Pacino's character, he's in there with the Turk and the bent cop, and yeah, you know he's going to shoot them, and there's the train going in the background, and his eyes are going, and you're looking back and forth, and his eyes are looking back and forth, and then he finally does. I mean, that's one of my favorite scenes in any film. So good. So yep. I absolutely love The Godfather. It's one of the, I haven't seen it for a long time. I'd get it out like every 2 years or so, it'd be on TV and I'd always watch it. I probably haven't seen it for about 5 or 6, 7 years now. Probably do a rewatch. It's just such a good film. Also interesting because Vito, the Marlon Brando character, despite being the Godfather, is clearly a person we're meant to respect. He's clearly a hero in some way. Given that he's a mafia boss, that's puts the viewer in a kind of interesting moral position as well. So that's what I like about The Godfather. Let's keep on going, because number 19, another horror classic, Night of the Living Dead, one of the better zombie movies ever made. One of the things I really like about Night of the Living Dead is that it's one of those films where nobody is likable in it. The main lead character, I think, is a black guy in it, but he's not very likable. He's not like, we're not quite rooting for him. We almost like want the people to die. And as ever with the zombie movie, the interest of the film is more about what's happening inside. It's more about the kind of terse relationships of the people inside the barricade than what is, you know, than the actual zombies and the looming threat. It's an interesting film about paranoia. It's an interesting film about I just think it's really, and it's very, very well done. You know, on next to no budget. Now, lots of horror fans love George A. Romero, and he made lots of these other, you know, Dawn of the Dead and all that. To be honest, I don't like any of the other ones. I think they're rubbish. Night of the Living Dead, though, is absolutely fantastic. It really is good, and well worth watching if you haven't watched it already. I like the fact that there is nobody to root for, really. You know, we kind of don't like the people, and that makes it more interesting. So let's keep on going then, because number 18 is Reservoir Dogs. Tarantino, of course. Now, I remember when this came out, and it was I wasn't that old in 1992, but you know, I remember it being a big kind of cultural thing, and then being a teenager around, you know, in the subsequent years, this would be one of the films to watch over and over again. I mean, it's cool. It's still, I think it's still cool now. You know, you've got all the different guys there, Mr. Blonde and Mr. Pink and Mr. White and Nice Guy Eddie, and one of the great performances of the film is this guy here, is Joe. He's such a grumpy old bastard, and I love the grumpiness of that performance. Steve Buscemi, you know, is great as Mr. Pink. Michael Madsen is such an evil prick as Mr. Blonde. It's great. Just a great all about the dialogue, of course, in Tarantino. You know, they have that whole conversation about Madonna being a virgin until she has sex with a black guy randomly. Just incidental dialogue. What's interesting about Reservoir Dogs is that it's like a donut. I mean, I don't know if you noticed, but the central action of the film is missing. What we get, so the main thing that happens is that there's a heist it's a robbery gone wrong, but we don't see the actual heist. What we see is flashbacks to beforehand, the aftermath and the fallout, but we never see the thing itself. So that's kind of a interesting writing technique that Tarantino uses, just like a donut. So that's interesting, I guess, too. But really, it's just kind of, you know, it is what it is. I think Tarantino is all about the style. It's all about coolness. It's all about the surfaces, witty dialogue. I don't know if it's trying to say anything deep or meaningful or profound, because it's meant to work at the level of kind of schlock, because that's the level of Tarantino. But I like that because I'm perfectly comfortable with postmodern texts. So there we go. I just think Reservoir Dogs is a ton of fun, really. Ton of fun. So number 17, I mentioned Shane Meadows before of This Is England. His best film, in my view, by some distance, is this one, Dead Men's Shoes. I mean, we've talked about bullying. This has some really disturbing scenes of bullying in it. It is haunting. It will stay with you. Paddy Considine is one of the great actors of our time, I would say. I mean, I have never seen him be in anything where he wasn't anything. I mean, he's just a tremendous actor. This is a fantastic film. One of the scenes that always sticks with me is that there's a like a disabled guy in this, and the way that he is taken advantage of is really quite sickening, I would say. One of the things I like about Dead Men's Shoes is how it depicts kind of group mentalities, how it shows how certain people, when they become like a minion, when they become like part of a group, how they lose their sense of what's decent or what's right and so on, as long as they're willing to go along with the crowd type thing. That is a theme that I find interesting. I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, I often think about how academics are a bit like that. They're so willing to go along with, you know, whatever's trendy right now, but in the process they kind of lose their soul. And there's something of that in what happens in Dead Men's Shoes. So if you haven't seen, I don't want to give too much of the what happens in it away, but Dead Men's Shoes is absolutely, I mean, it's uncomfortable, but it's brilliant, I think. Well, probably in terms of British movies, one of the best British films of the past 20, 30 years, something like that. So let's keep on going. Number 16 is The Shining, another Stanley Kubrick film. Kubrick has made a lot of, he's racked up a lot of films on this list, which is impressive, given that he only made like 13 films. But every single one of them was special in some way. And The Shining, I mean, what is there to say that hasn't been said? I mean, it's creepy. It's scary. The first time I watched The Shining, I was obviously too young to watch it because I was 14 and it was on my own television in my own room. And it was on at like 11 o'clock and I watched it on my own when I was 14. And I was probably traumatized by it. I mean, to watch it when you're 14 alone, probably psychologically scarred because it's so, I mean, that, you know, the... It's unsettling. One of the things I love about The Shining is obviously the central performance of Jack Nicholson. What's interesting about it is that he's clearly gone. He's clearly not right as the film starts. You know, you see him even before they go to the hotel. this guy is not right. I mean, if you saw a guy who looked like that walking in the street, you'd wonder why, like, should he be allowed out, you know? So that's one of the things. He's clearly already not with it before they go. And that's something that I've always found kind of fascinating about what happens in the Shining. Shelley Duvall is really good. I mean, famously, they said that she was never quite right after making this film. But she's very good in it. And, you know, it's tricky with the kid actors, but whoever the kid is pretty good in it as well. So, yes. It's a great film. I seem to remember reading somewhere that Stephen King never liked it. I mean, I don't really care. You know, I don't really, Stephen King is one of these people somehow who has had loads of his books turned into like very good films. I don't know how, like how good a writer he is himself. I think a lot of the artistry here was probably coming from the Kubrick side rather than the Stephen King side, to be honest. All work and no play makes Jack a very dull boy, yes. Yep, Red Rum, all the rest of it, Shining. And I love the pull-out at the end. I love the little picture and the kind of when they're going into the kind of ballroom, and the vibe of it is so, so good, so well done. So The Shining, basically a perfect film. In my view, number 15, one of my absolutely famous picks is Nuts in May. it's my ambition, it's my dream and ambition to get enough people to watch this film for the Guardian to write an article to say, why has Nuts in May become an alt-right? You know, why are alt-right trolls watching Nuts in May? You know, this is what I want. My ultimate dream is for Nuts in May to be condemned by the Guardian because it's been picked up by the right wing. To me, it's a very funny comedy. It's a look at this impossibly middle-class couple, Keith and Candice Marie, who've got all these kind of right-on values. I just love the character of Keith. I just love how autistic he is and spurgy he is about everything. I mean, even in this little scene now, have you seen my minimum maximum thermometer? So I don't know. There's something about Nuts in May. I can't get enough of it. It's my dream and ambition to get all of my, like all 40,000 people sub to this channel to watch Nuts in May at least once, and then for enough people to talk about it for the Guardian to write about it. It's so good. Yeah, get PJW to do a review of it. Yeah, that would be, well, Froggy, if you're watching this, you're the one who's got it in with PJW. So there we go. Righto. I would talk more about Nuts in May. But probably my video on the middle class has got enough eyeballs on Nuts in May recently. But I also think that Candice Marie, one of the little things I love about Nuts in May is that even though Keith seems like he's the one who's in charge, it's really Candice Marie who's pushing him. She's the one who's needling, and she gets under his skin, and she kind of, it's not fair, Keith. Go on. Go and have a word. Didn't take a blind bit of notice, Keith. And she's just kind of playing with him. And then she's like, oh, I'll go and see it. Like she wants to go and see Ray, and she kind of makes him jealous. And she, it's really, I mean, I love the kind of subtle, I'm always interested in that idea that the, you know, between the ostensibly dominant one and the ostensibly submissive one, it's actually the submissive one who has secret control. And Candice Marie has that, you know, she is really the one who's driving the show between the two of them. And she plays Keith a lot during it. You know, she works a little rivalry between Keith and Ray. And yeah, so I love the kind of subtleties of Nuts in May as well. And every once in a while, I'll get that out to cheer myself up a bit. I watched it over Christmas again with Mrs. AA, who was like, "What again? You want to watch Nuts in May again?" But then she didn't regret it. She was like, "Oh yeah, it's really good." So number 14, fantastic movie, which I watch again, another film from 2000. Look, Battle Royale, featuring one of my all-time favorite characters, which is the teacher there, right in the middle. I love the rant the teacher goes on at the start. It's one of the all-time grumpy old men against the world, against the youth. I mean, I've always hated the youth, as people know. I hate the youth. And the rant that teacher goes on at the start is, I mean, one of my all-time favorite things in any movie ever is the teacher in Battle Royale. But then, of course, the setup is they're gonna have this fight to the death, and it's just amazing. I didn't know anything about this. It came on like Channel 4, at some time in 2002 or something. They just randomly showed it, and I couldn't believe how good it was when I saw it. And it was one of those things. I mean, back then everything wasn't online, and you weren't always in touch with everyone. And I couldn't believe how good it was. And it was only years later I found out that, you know, this movie had something of a cult following, and I could speak to other people who liked it as well. So, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. I did hate the youth when I was a youth. Yes. And it is my only Japanese film. It is. It's my only Japanese. Unless you count Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which was co-funded by... it was a joint British Japanese production, which is not to say that there aren't good. If I was making a Sight and Sound star list, I'd put some Kurosawa on there, you know, Ran or Throne of Blood or something like that. They're a little bit slow going. I also like Rashomon. Rashomon is a really good film, which is, if you were going to do an interesting film double bill, you could do Citizen Kane or Rashomon back to back, because they both do that thing where they play with narrative, they play with different perspectives on the same thing. So there are some tremendous. Audition is a great movie I haven't put on the list. Audition is the only film that I've ever actually thrown up during. I had to stop the film, and I was sick in the toilet watching Audition because it made me that nauseous. So there, there's some great Japanese J horror. The Grudge is a spooky movie. But there are only 100 spots on the list, and there were other picks that I wanted to feature instead. But Battle Royale is one of my all time. It's so much fun. I love its indifference. I love its indifference to the suffering. Like, it's just so brutal, and it's so unapologetic for itself. I love the film for all those reasons. And like I said, that teacher is one of my absolute all-time favorite characters in anything as well. So let's keep on going, because number 13 is another one of my all-time favorites. We're getting into big boy territory now. These are films I really love. And this is Alfred Hitchcock's Rope. The only Hitchcock movie I put on. And it's not, I love a lot of Hitchcock's films. I love North by Northwest and Vertigo and Rear Window and Dial M for Murder. There's that amazing scene at the end where he combs his moustache. Hitchcock's amazing. Psycho is good, apart from the last 5 minutes, which I hate. But Psycho is great. But Rope is the one of Hitchcock's that I really, really love, because the setup is these two gentlemen that you're seeing here. Their name is the one holding up the glass is Brandon, and the guy next to him is Philip. And the idea, they've been reading a lot of Nietzsche or some philosopher like Nietzsche. It's not actually said, but it's strongly suggested they've been reading Nietzsche. And they've got this idea into their heads that they are superior to their classmates. They're superior to their fellow human beings, these two. And they have this professor who they really like, who's played by James Stewart in the film. playing against type in many ways. And James Stewart is very good. But anyway, this guy Brandon, he thinks that the professor is too theoretical with all of these kind of Nietzschean ideas, and he wants to put the ideas into practice. So they hatch a plan that they're going to kill their classmate David. And this is not a spoiler because it happens like in the first second of the film. They kill their classmate David, and then to make the perfect crime, they're going to invite all his friends and family to basically have a dinner party while he's dead there in the room. And that is what happens in Rope. One of the reasons that Rope is famous is because the whole film is just one tracking shot. I mean, Hitchcock couldn't actually find tape long enough to do the whole thing. So there are a couple of edit points, and it's usually where you see it, like he'll zoom into somebody's back or something like that. But still, the whole thing is you watch it and it's as if it's all one take. It's a play essentially. It's a very talky film, but I really like it. I really love Brandon is an aesthete, and he has a complete disregard for kind of morality or people's lives or anything like this. And if I was going to make my great villains list, Brandon from Rope would be in there, because he's a magnificent prick as well, and I love that about him. The other guy, Philip, he can't really handle it as well. And there's it's hinted at that these two may be gay as well, possibly. He struggles a lot with it, and he's very guilty and he's shaky. But Brandon is like effortlessly cool all the way through it. So Rope is a great, it's like a reverse suspense film. It's more the threat of people finding out about what they've done through it. So that makes it great. I think the script is very good as well. I think the writer was Patrick Hamilton. So let's keep on going, because number 12, we're at the business end now, is American Psycho. Another really good film. I think this was the role that Christian Bale was born to play. I mean, he's so good. Another film from 2000. Look, I mean, maybe 2000 was the best year for film of all time. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of 2000 films. But basically perfect rendition of Patrick Bateman. One of the things I like about American Psycho is that you're never quite sure if anything you're seeing is real or not. Maybe it's just his kind of lurid imagination. Maybe he's just fantasizing at his desk. Maybe it did happen. Maybe it didn't. It's got scenes that I love. The scene where he just randomly kills that tramp just because he can. I mean, dialogue is amazing. The scene where he's looking at the guy's, they whip out the business cards. That's incredible. Cool it with the anti-Semitic remarks. just a great film in all ways. Iconic scenes. And I've just noticed a female director. So there we go. I really like American Psycho. I don't know why it wasn't more highly rated when it came out. I seem to remember I had a lot of like 3 and 4 star reviews. I mean, why? It should have 5 star reviews. So I think American Psycho stood the test of time. Terrific performance, and kind of interesting look at a certain type of corporate mindset, I guess. There's a novel which is quite disturbing, where even more kind of obscene things happen, I prefer the film to the novel, I think. Not that I read novels, of course. So let's keep on going. Pulp Fiction is number 11. Another great film from Tarantino, of course. One of the things I think is underrated about Pulp Fiction is just how funny it is. It's a really, really funny film. Hilarious. I mean, some of the memorable moments in it, everybody quotes, but it's just so funny. So many hilarious things happen in it. Again, great script. Royale with cheese, all the rest of it. What more can be said? So I still really rate the Tarantino stuff. And I don't see why anybody wouldn't. If you want, again, it's all the kind of cool surfaces. It's all about the witty dialogue and the funniness. If you're looking for like something deep and profound, you go and watch the Ingmar Bergman film, go and watch Fanny Alexander. Not what I'm looking for from Tarantino. So there we go. So let's have a look at the super chats then. Just two that I can see. Architect of Fate says, if Blazing Saddles is not on this list, you can get out now. It is proof comedy and moral principles can save any society. I mean, I do like Blazing Saddles, but it's not on the list, I'm afraid. I do like it. Don't get me wrong, but it's just, there were 100 other films I wanted to pick. Gandhi Bob Flankis says, have you seen the old BBC dramatization of Tinker Tailor, Soldier, Spy, and Smiley's People? It's right up your street. Alec Guinness is brilliant. Actually, I haven't. I read a lot about it because do you remember when Tinker Tailor, Soldier, Spy came out again? There was a lot of talk of that older one. No, I haven't seen them. So it's on my to-do list. But to be honest, these past few years, I've been less inclined to. I went through a long period of not being able to watch any films. I'd get up Netflix or I'd go through and I was like, I can't be bothered. I'd rather do something else. It's only been recently that my kind of love for film has been reignited, I guess. I'm trying to think of what kickstarted that. What was it? I watched something and I thought, well, that's really good. Wasn't the last Star Wars, I'll tell you that much. Okay. So let's hit the top 10 then, shall we? We've made very good time, haven't we? We're still less than 2 hours in. So let's have a look. Okay. Top 10 time. Number 10 is Frank Darabont's The Mist. I think I want to say Stephen King wrote this as well, but and another film from 2007. Now, The Mist, for me, remember I was saying in Night of the Living Dead about how the real enemy is the enemy within, not the enemy without? Well, The Mist is one of the ultimate films for this because there are all these, this mist comes over this town, and there are all these kind of weird creatures in the mist. This town ends up getting, trapped in this supermarket. Obviously, they've got food and stuff around them. But then obviously the question within the supermarket comes about, well, how are we going to deal with this? What are we going to do? And this is what I like. I like the pressure cooker atmosphere of what happens within that supermarket, the political questions that come up, some of the religious questions that come up, but also just the nature of man, the nature of the people, that ultimately they're all really just out for their survival and some of these baser instincts coming out in, so it's the horror within rather than the horror out there. So that's one of the things I really like about The Mist. The other thing I really like about The Mist, and I don't want to give away what happens in it. I just love the end. The ending is unbelievably bleak. It is. I mean, it's just beyond, it's staggeringly. It's one of the most horrendous things that I can think of that happens in any film. I love The Mist for that as well. So for me, and this will be controversial, I think The Mist is the best horror film. I'd happily argue ever made, but I'd certainly argue for the past like 30 years, 40 years or something like that. I really think The Mist did not get the plaudits it deserved at the time. And I mean, I don't know, maybe since I haven't really looked, to be honest, but I'd imagine it still hasn't really been given its due. I thought it was a masterpiece, and I continue to believe that it's maybe one day people will realize what I'm saying about this. So my pick for the best horror, certainly of recent years, but possibly also of all time. Number nine, another film from 2007, is P.T. Anderson's fantastic There Will Be Blood. And this would have been my pick for the best Oscar picture that year as well. It lost out to No Country for Old Men. I mean, how good is There Will Be Blood? Again, do you remember what I was saying about the duel of wits, the duel of wills? Well, it's the duel between these two characters here, the Daniel Plainview, the capitalist, kind of evil capitalist, versus the culty religious guy on the left here. I forget the actor. Is his name Paul Dano? I want to say he is very good at playing a wormy little kind of... He is so detestable, the Paul Dano character in There Will Be Blood. And it's interesting because the Plainview character is obviously a bastard as well. So it's this duel of wills, this duel between two people who we don't like. We don't like either of them, but they're both really fascinating characters. That's the heart of There Will Be Blood. But also the you know, I like some of the big performances. Daniel Day-Lewis, who's, again, one of the best actors, you know, in movie history, without doubt. And he's been good in lots of these. He was great in The Crucible. He was great in My Left Foot. He was great in... I mean, he's basically good in everything. I didn't like Lincoln that much, but he's basically good in everything he's ever been in. To me, this is his best performance. There Will Be Blood. Of course, you know, I Drink Your Milkshake and Drainage and all the rest of it. It's so good. I can't get enough of it. I also love the spiel he goes on. You know, I want no one else to succeed. I have a competition in me. I hate most people. It's so good. One of my favorite films ever. And I said at the time when There Will Be Blood came out, some people didn't like it. And I said, trust me, in 20 years' time, when people look back at this decade, they'll say this was the film of this decade. And in 20 or 30 years' time, people will look back and they'll start putting their top 100 of all time lists, AFA, you know, all time type lists. And I've looked, and There Will Be Blood has acquired this sort of status since 2007. So partly I'm happy that I made a correct call back in 2007. Yeah, I stand by my asset. And one of the other things is that P.T. Anderson's direction in the film is interesting too. There's a BBC critic who I used to listen to quite a lot called Mark Commode, who is, he's a leftist. Let's face it, like a Marxist, basically. Somebody told me that they found like an old introduction that Mark Commode had done to my 100 pick, you know, in The Company of Men, and it was all like intersectionality and all this stuff. I mean, okay, but that doesn't mean to say he's never said anything worth listening to about film. And I remember that back at this time when he was talking about There Will Be Blood, he was talking about how P.T. Anderson kind of reimagined cinematic narrative in this film. He was doing something new in the way that he told this story, in the way that it was shot, in the way that the sound works in the film. So it's really interesting from that point of view as well. So I rate this film extremely highly. There Will Be Blood. Number eight is The Godfather Part Two. Now, I rated this, I mean, the placements would suggest that I rate Godfather 2 a lot higher than Godfather 1. That's not the case at all. I think the first Godfather is an amazing film. Basically, all of the films in this, like maybe in the top 40, are spectacular movies. You know, we're at the stage now where even though one film is 20 and the other one is 8, that doesn't mean anything. It's not a knock on the one that's 20. It just means I wanted to mention like 10 other films in between. The reason I put Godfather 2 here is because I really like the narrative arc and the journey that Michael Corleone goes on as the film, and you've got the dual narrative of the rise of Vito Corleone and the kind of internal demise. So even though Michael Corleone in material terms is going up, his soul is dying, you know. It's so the parallel in Godfather 2 is Vito Corleone, who is essentially an honorable character. He's kind of, like I said, he's a hero. He, you know, we're meant to like him. He is somebody who is using corruption to gain power. Okay. That's his arc. But Michael Corleone's arc is that Lord Acton thing. It is how absolute power corrupts absolutely. So we're seeing how while Vito is using corruption to gain power, Michael has power and is being absolutely corrupted by it. Now, I mean, I don't know about spoilers. I mean, if you haven't seen Godfather Part 2 at this point, sort your life out. But obviously, Michael does one of the worst things you can possibly do to, you know, as a human being in this film, unimaginable. And one of my favorite shots in movie history is when he's just sitting on that bench alone at the end, sad, with nothing but kind of his own memories to haunt him. Yes, he's the Godfather. Yes, but ultimately he's got nothing. And I love the kind of hollowness. In terms of career performances, obviously Pacino's had loads of them, but I think he is absolutely phenomenal in Godfather Part 2. And loads of other cool things happen in it as well. Hyman Roth is a great character, and there's the whole thing about what's his name, Frankie, the guy who ends up giving himself the Roman suicide. So yeah, Godfather 2, obviously a great movie. Number 7, another one of my favorite themes, as I've talked about, is the duels of wits, duels of psychological battles between two male protagonists. And here in Sleuth, we have the ultimate version of that. This guy on the right, played by Laurence Olivier. Now, for me, Laurence Olivier is quite a hammy actor in a lot of things. I don't really love him as a Shakespearean actor. I could take or leave his Hamlet or the Richard III and all the rest. So I don't really care for all that sort of stuff. He's good in The Entertainer, the John Osborne film. He's good in that. But for me, his career best performance is he's good in Marathon Man. But he's good. His best performance ever is in this film for me, Sleuth, as this detective novelist, Milo Tyndall. And the whole setup here is that Milo is this aging novelist who lives in this big country mansion, and he's obsessed with games. He's obsessed with toys and games, and he's got all sorts of weird kind of figurines and games from all around the world. His wife is a woman of very expensive tastes, but she has been cheating on him with a much younger man, played by Michael Caine. And so the setup of the film is that Milo, Michael Caine's character is called Andrew. Milo invites Andrew to come to his mansion because he's got a proposal for him. And I won't say any more than that because part of the thriller. I mean, it's a bit of a whodunit type thing. It's a, like a mystery setup. Anyway, it becomes quickly clear that he has got, it's not just the proposal he's there for. There are some other aspects of gamesmanship involved. And the whole film is watching these two men trying to demonstrate their masculinity to each other, trying to one up the other, and playing kind of very dangerous psychological games with each other, trying to break each other. And I find that a very interesting theme play out. So yes, it's this director here, Joseph L. Mankiewicz, people don't really talk about him, but I think he's directed a lot of good films. And his direction in this film is especially, it's kind of witty, you know, there's a lot of witty little kind of visual jokes that are told in the way that he makes this. But the central performance is, I mean, Michael Caine is really good in the I think they were both nominated for Oscars for this film. I think it's the only film ever where both actors were nominated for Best Oscar. But they both lost out, of course, to Marlon Brando for The Godfather in 1972. So that's what happened there. But I really rate Sleuth. It was another one of those films that I watched when I was a teenager on my own, randomly came on Channel 4 one night. And I just thought, wow, this is something, this film. But I've gone back to it. And there's one of my all-time favorite sequences in any film is the rant that Milo's character gives to Andrew. You know, he's like, he's like, but why, Andrew? But why? It's because I hate you. I hate you because you're not one of me. You're a blue-eyed, culling wop, a jumped-up pantry boy who never knew his place. I mean, it's so good. It's unreal. So, yeah, Sleuth, amazing. And clearly, Morrissey was a fan of this film because he quotes that, you know, the jumped-up pantry boy who never knew his place. That's in a Smith song as well. So let's keep on going, because number six, another kind of essentially a play that's been turned into a movie, just like Sleuth was, and Rope, is Glengarry Glen Ross. Another Pacino film. Pacino is in this film. Kevin Spacey's there as well. Alec Baldwin, of course. Now, this film is awesome. It is an ensemble piece, Alec Baldwin character here, he comes in at the start, and they're all salesmen, they're real estate salesmen, and he says, listen, you're all fired. The top two, like the top guy gets a car, second guy gets a set of steak knives, everybody else is fired. And then you watch the pressure cooker of all of these guys fighting to keep their jobs. That's the movie. What I love about it is the it's got so, I mean, for me, it's probably the most masculine film ever made. It is, I mean, it's a pure look at the male ego, I guess. It's all about what it is that makes men specifically, not women, men. I don't think there are any women in the actual film at all, from what I can remember. That there's a sense of high. I mean, you could probably rank the characters in terms of their hierarchy. You know, that clearly the alpha is the Al Pacino character, Ricky Roma. But then there's a very clear beta in the film played by Ed Harris. Then the Alan Arkin is in the film, a decent actor as well. But for me, the star of this movie is Jack Lemmon. Jack Lemmon is so good in this film. The bitterness in it, like the desperation that reeks from his portrayal of Shelley Devine in this film is something else. And there are so many just cold moments. You know, I posted a bit on this on Twitter the other day, and Morgoth just said, this film is so bleak, I can't believe it. But I just love it. I can't get enough of Glengarry Glen Ross. I mean, it's all about that little sense of like who is where in the pack, in the hierarchy, who is going to be the alpha here, who is going to, and it's just raw. That's what I love about it. It's just so relentless in its focus on that. Alec Baldwin, that, I mean, he's only in one scene, and it was written specially. It's not in the play. It's only David Mamet wrote it specially just for Baldwin to come in and give that. That's just one of the all-time great things. Pacino is great as well in the film. I mean, he has a rant at one point where he calls Kevin Spacey a fairy. You fairy, you child, company man. So good. I can't. Ed Harris is good. Everything is so good. I would strongly recommend Glengarry Glen Ross. I also just love one of the interesting dynamics in it is that you feel for Jack Lemmon's character because of the, you know, there's an awful lot of pathos there. You really think, oh God, but he's also a detestable prick. You know, whenever he's on top, whenever he gets a little bit of victory, then he starts to try to put other people down. That's the thing. It kind of unveils, like, anytime anybody's on top, you see their true colors in the film, and you see that in the Jack Lemmon character as well. So it doesn't allow you really to like him. He deserved what, you know. The other thing I'll say is that there's an amazing moment in the film where towards the end, where Jack Lemmon gives Pacino a look, and just the what is exchanged non-verbally in that moment, again, one of my favorite little moments in any film ever. So number six, Glengarry Glen Ross. Number five is another Kubrick film, and one of my all-time. I mean, obviously, it's number five. I can't get enough of Clockwork Orange. I saw it, another one of these films I saw when I was a teenager. Of course, it was banned for many years in the UK, and I want to say it was unbanned relatively recently. It was like banned for like 30 years. So let's see. It would have come back out in the 90s, because it was a big deal when I was a teenager that Clockwork Orange was going to come out on DVD and finally we could watch it, and all this, it was going to come out on video or something. And it was going to be shown on TV for the first time ever, or all this sort of stuff, because it was banned. Why do I love Clockwork Orange? Well, aesthetically, obviously it's a cool film. But again, it's this exploration of the nature of evil, and the fact that Alex is doing all of these things by choice. It's not a compulsion, like, he knows it's wrong, and yet he chooses to do it anyway. So that is an interesting thing. And obviously the writer Anthony Burgess is Catholic, so there's quite a lot of there's quite a kind of religious questions and the nature of morality and stuff being asked as well. But there are other reasons to love Clockwork Orange beyond just that, and beyond the, you know, I've talked about Kubrick's obsessive kind of lens, you know, the slightly autistic lens that he looks at things through. I can't, you know, but beyond that, what about the kind of slightly weird British Monty Python-esque atmosphere of the whole thing? You know, one of my favorite characters in it is that kind of social worker who comes to see him at the start. And I drive Mrs. AA nuts, because I, every once in a while, we'll just be sitting there and I'll start saying, yes, Alex boy. Cause I just love the slightly surreal nature of the British actors who are in it. And a lot of these guys you'll recognize from, you know, the Dad's Army or various different kind of, they were like regular actors from British TV and things, and they're just kind of there. Patrick McGee, of course, is in there. Dave Prowse is there. I mean, it's just so good. I can't quite put the words on why I love Clockwork Orange as much as I do. Another little theme of it that I like the fact that the other droogies, you know, the tagalongs, the little the minions, if you want, they end up becoming cops. So it's just like they're just like Alex, but they're on the other side now, you know. Yep, the ultra violence, yeah. So let's keep on going. I mean, what else is there to say? It's Clockwork Orange, for God's sake. Top film for me. Number four, you may recognize the guy on the left here. That's George Sanders. A lot of people say, "Where's your avatar from?" It's from my number four pick, All About Eve, another Joseph L. Mankiewicz film from 1950. I mean, what can I say about All About Eve? Tremendous performances. I mean, George Sanders on career best form. I think he won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for All About Eve. But the film is all about this woman you see on the right here. She plays Eve Harrington. And there's a Betty Davis is in the film as well. And she plays an aging actress whose days as a kind of leading woman are drawing towards a close. And George Sanders is a very influential theatre critic called Addison DeWitt. And, you know, the reason I picked him as my avatar is because it was a little nod. It was a little nod to the fact that I may also be a critic of some description. So the fact that I think George Sanders is really cool. But the whole setup of the film is that Eve Harrington is just this ambitious young girl who wants to get into acting. And she starts out as a kind of, she just wants to be an assistant. Oh, I just want to help out, you know. And she kind of stalks Betty Davis's character a little bit, and she studies her. But it's clear that she's studying her because she wants to be in her place. And it's really interesting because, I mean, I've talked a lot about the male ego, but you see a lot of the female ego in this film. You know, the young glamorous rising star Eve, and the old older actress who's starting, you know, her looks are starting to go, and she's starting to get worried about it, and she doesn't want to lose her place, and it's really something. And the Addison DeWitt character, George Sanders's character here, he is a very sinister presence in the film. He is basically an evil character. I have not, wouldn't surprise people that I'd pick an evil character as my avatar as opposed to a goodie. But he'd be on my list of top villains ever in films, because he plays like a kind of Svengali character behind, like he's trying to Betty Davis's character is called Margot Channing. He wants Margot basically to shuffle off, and he wants Eve Harrington in her place because he, as a critic, has got kind of some appreciation of what Eve is up to. So I really like All About Eve. As with all of Joseph L. Mankiewicz's films, but especially this one and Sleuth, the script is so intelligent. It's so sparkling wit, crisp delivery. And it's a film like this is one of the sorts of things that makes me wonder, maybe Ed Dutton is right that people are getting more stupid as time goes on. Because I don't think this film could be made today, because half the audience wouldn't understand what was being said. But anyway, All About Eve, absolutely phenomenal movie. Well, you can see I put it at number four here. So number three, another play turned into a film. This one, Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And another aging kind of actress, I should have mentioned Betty Davis is superb in All About Eve as well, but is Elizabeth Taylor as what are their names? Martha as Martha here, and Richard Burton as George. Yeah. And of course, they were married in real life, Burton and Taylor. And famously, they were, you know, it was a rocky relationship. It was an explosive relationship, which made them basically perfect to play George and Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. The acting is phenomenal in this film. The script is fizzing. And again, so all of these duels of wits and duels of wills we've been talking about, you know, have tended to be two blokes. It's been like male versus male, or in the case of All About Eve, it's woman versus woman. But in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, it's a husband versus wife. You know, they're playing these kind of really sick psychological games with each other. George is a kind of history professor. He's not doing that well in his career. His wife, Martha, is a very domineering woman. She's difficult. She's braying. She kind of cucks him. He is kind of like seething resentment underneath it all. And a younger couple comes to kind of a new guy's joined the college, basically, and they've invited them over. And they basically just have like the kind of party from hell, basically. I love Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It is, it's a haunting film in many ways. Like so many of these films, it's disturbing. But I really think it's one of the best films ever made, obviously. Hilariously, I once tried to watch it with my dad, and he was like, what are you trying to make me watch here? Like, what's wrong with you? So that was funny. But still. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Strongly recommended. If you've never seen it, you really should. Basically, the ultimate in couples fighting movie, I guess. But really psychologically dark as well. I don't want to give too much away. I mean, it's difficult to talk about these things without giving away major plot spoilers, so I won't. But there's some kind of little secret that they've got between them. I'll just put it that way. And the way that was played with in their various games is really quite, I hate to say it's dark. It's very dark. All right. Number two, everybody has been waiting for this. It's of course Labyrinth. how could I not put it right at the top of my list here? What can I say? I mean, I love David Bowie, but I've seen this film hundreds of times. I've seen this film so often that you can put it on mute and I can fill the words in. You know very well where he is. Time is short. You have 13 hours in which to solve the labyrinth before your baby brother becomes one of us forever. Such a pity. So why do I love Labyrinth as much as I do, other than the fact that I've seen it so many times? What I like about it is that it's all about Sarah on the right here. She thinks she's older than she is. She's a teenager. She's going through adolescence. And Jareth is, it's obviously an adult situation. And she is obviously still just a child. So she's trying to grow up too early. So it's kind of like a reverse Buildings Roman. So in a normal Buildings Roman, you have a young character who goes through a journey and they discover that they kind of grow up on the course of the journey. Whereas Labyrinth is almost like a reverse one. It is Sarah realizing that she's still just a kid ultimately, and she shouldn't be in these situations that are too much for them. And she needs to actually hold on to these childhood things. So that's really what that's my reading of what Labyrinth is about. It's an interesting film because it's written by Terry Jones of Monty Python fame, So it's got all these like little bits of British humor all the way through it. It's a lot more comical and funny than you think of a fantasy film like this. And this is what I was saying about the Dark Crystal. The Dark Crystal is very straight, whereas the Labyrinth is very tongue in cheek. It's kind of the script is very sly. And I love that about it. She comes to realize that she needs all her friends, Hoggle and Ludo and all the rest of them. And somewhat in that mood earlier on Twitter, I sent out a tweet saying, listen, I appreciate all my guys on here, even you, Mark. So there's bits of that as well. But of course, one of the key reasons to love this film is for the performance of David Bowie as the Goblin King, because he's sinister. He's kind of toys with this girl. I love all of the showdowns between Jareth and Sarah. From the minute that he presents her with a crystal at the start to the final showdown, you have no power over me and all that. It's great. It really is great. I like the aesthetic. I like the animatron, like the puppets, the Jim Henson puppets, and little jokes, as I said. So Labyrinth, absolutely phenomenal. Now, I haven't seen The Labyrinth in some time, because the last time I watched Labyrinth, I was in floods of tears at the end of it, because it was the first time in so many times watching it that I had realized that it was just a dream. Like somebody said, oh, you realize it was just a dream. I was like, no. And it floored me. I mean, I was like a 32 year old man at the time, which is pathetic to think about. But for some reason that hit me. And it's made me question, like, does any of these things happen, or is it just a dream, or what? But the idea that it was just a dream was too much for me to bear on that occasion, and I don't want to think about it. So I haven't actually seen The Labyrinth since then, because it meant too much. So there we go. And any guessing what my number one is, given where I've gone with my number two? It is, of course, Mary Poppins. Basically, a practically perfect film in every way. Probably the last great project Disney worked on before he died, bringing this kind of old morality tale to the screen. What can I say about it? I mean, Julie Andrews is absolutely, I mean, they couldn't have picked a better person to play Mary Poppins. But for me, all of the action of the film is about this guy here, about Mr. Banks. The best character, my all-time hero, one of the all-time best characters in any film, is Mr. Banks. He runs his he wants to run his home with tradition and discipline and rules, and he's a banker, and he's an Englishman in 1910, and he's got a very firm sense of himself. And I mean, to me, he's basically amazing even before Poppins comes into it. But I think people misunderstand Mary Poppins. Some people have said that Mary Poppins is a critique of Western metaphysics, that it's a kind of critique of rationalism, that you need to understand more about human nature. You need to understand more. You can't just have rationalism. And this is ultimately the lesson that Mary Poppins wants to teach the Mr. Banks here. She wants to teach him that that you need more than just the system two thinking. You need the system one too. You need the emotional brain. You need to engage some part of you need to have the intuition. You need to have the so you can't just have instrumental reason alone. So in that way you could say, well, Mary Poppins is almost like a kind of German idealist looking at a Jeremy Bentham type figure, something like that. Almost kind of like a Nietzschean critique of Bentham or something like this, you could say. But having said all of that, it is still it's a conservative film, because yes, the children, they so at the start, Mr. Banks writes a note about what his perfect nanny would be, a nanny that should give commands. But the kids also, they do their own kind of saccharine. They want a nanny who's going to give them sweets and who's going to kind of have fun with them and this sort of thing. And one of the things that people don't, Mr. Banks, absolute Chad, just rips it up and throws it in the bin. But one of the things people don't appreciate is that Mary Poppins, yes, she is the kid's perfect nanny, but she is also Mr. Banks's perfect nanny. She does give commands. She is disciplined. She does put her foot down. She's basically the perfect Edwardian nanny. She just teaches the kids that, okay, you need to do tough things in life that you don't want to do. You need to clean up your room. When I say you're going to go home, you're going to go home. So she teaches them all sorts of discipline. If you remember, it's the corrupting influence is Bert. Bert's the one who wants to stay with a tea party on the ceiling. He's the one who wants to stay. But she's like, no, it's time to go home. We're going to go home now. And she sticks by the rules. She won't work on her day off. She won't, she does everything by the book, her own book, but she sticks by her own rules. And that is something as well. That I think people, it's not a subversive correction to Mr. Banks. It's just, she actually adds something. She just says, look, you have to do all these things, but you take a spoonful of sugar as well, and it will help the medicine go down. But ultimately, the medicine is important. All right. Thank you very much, everyone, for watching my top 100 movies. Interesting for everyone. Yes, I really love Mary Poppins. I can't get enough of it. I love Mary Poppins so much that once when I was first started dating Mrs. A, took me to a Mary Poppins party, and I went as Mr. Banks and she went as Poppins, and I couldn't they actually put it on, and I had to leave because the emotion of it was too much for me. So it's these two films, the Poppins and Labyrinth, are ones I've seen so much that they're almost like a part of me. So that's why I couldn't not put them at the very top. Okay, so. So people are saying I'm strangely emotional. Yeah, there we go. So people say I'm metrosexual. Come on now. Come on. Enough. So let's have a look at any last super chats that have come in. Charlemagne says, I bought a copy of Nuts in May on eBay. Charlemagne, absolutely brilliant. You need to get Nuts in May into the distributor, get the distributors to watch it, get some of your alt-right buddies to watch it. I want everybody watching. Make a video about it on your channel. Like, I want all the edgy boys need to be watching Nuts in May. Silly Sailor says, if one isn't AA trolling, I will be disappointed. No, I'm not trolling at all. Mary Poppins is my number one movie. Sol Invictus says, skipped out of work to catch the top 10. Okay. Well, I mean, that's good dedication. I very much appreciate that you did that. Sol Invictus is the top AA fan for actually leaving work early to catch the top 10. Greed, the Aberisher, says, Labyrinth ain't number one, third biscuit eater. Well, it was number two. I mean, it was pretty high. And the Wooster says, based AA dabbing on everyone and realizing how great Mary Poppins actually is. I mean, it's all that and more. Mary Poppins is the best film. In terms of what it's trying to do, I don't know of a film that nails it quite as perfectly as it's basically a perfect film. Every single part of it is. I mean, I haven't even talked about, like, you know, the Admiral Boom and Albus and just go and watch that scene. They go to the bank, and they try to convince Michael that he needs to invest his tuppence in the bank rather than feed the birds. And the song that the bankers sing, trying to convince him to invest the tuppence, is phenomenal. You know, railways through Africa. I mean, it's tremendous. So I can't praise Mary Poppins anymore. I've put it number one on my list. And I think that'll do. So, get out. Some people can't see past the end of their own nose.